I'd like to welcome everyone today to our audio conference workshop entitled Human Trafficking, specifically Trafficking of U.S. Citizens, led by Anna Rodriguez, a law enforcement victim advocate who created and operates the Florida Coalition Against Human Trafficking. This workshop will demonstrate how Christians and social work can come together to address the complex issues surrounding domestic human trafficking and collaborate on strategies to prevent trafficking, as well as identify, rescue, and restore human lives when it does take place. It will also show how lack of financial support and services for domestic workplaces, a larger burden on faith-based and community agencies to secure resources to do their work. Just before we begin our session, let me quickly cover a few important housekeeping items. First of all, for parts of today's session, we'll be using a muting function to eliminate any background noise that might compete with Anna's presentation. You can probably hear some of that background noise even as we're starting here. However, at different intervals, we'll disable the muting function and enter a live mode so that any of you can make comments or raise questions for discussion. Please be aware that during the live portions of this conference, any background noise in your office or home can be heard, crying babies, barking dogs, so you might want to do your best during those times to try to minimize those outside noises as much as possible so everyone can hear the questions and also the answers. Secondly, a reminder that today's call will be recorded so that folks who aren't able to participate in the call will still be able to learn from the material that's presented today. And it's our obligation to let you know that the session will be recorded. Thirdly, if it's at all possible, you'll find it helpful to follow the online PowerPoint presentation that we provided you with access to when you registered for the audio conference. If for any reason you haven't been able to access this outline, please let me know via email right away. I'm at rick@nacsw.org, and I'll send you a copy as an email attachment within the next few minutes so that you'll have that for your use. And fourthly, during questions and answer periods, do your best to keep your questions and comments crisp and to the point, and that way we can keep the session moving and cover as much material as possible. So now, without any further ado, I'm delighted to present our speaker, Anna Rodriguez.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. And before we start, I would like to know a little bit of each one of you. If you could please state your name and where are you calling from, and what is the agency that you're representing.
Hello, Anna. This is Paul Regan. I'm calling from Chicago, Illinois, and I'm with the Christian Association for Psychological Studies.
And Anna, my name is John Eric Swenson. I'm a licensed psychologist, and I'm currently chairman of the board for the Christian Association for Psychological Studies.
And hello, Anna. This is Sharon Stetler. I am on the same board, the CAPS board, and I'm a licensed professional counselor. I'm calling from Knoxville, Tennessee.
And Anna, this is Carl Holland. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. This is Barb Matchett Kirkwood from Indiana Wesleyan University. I'm faculty in social work here, and I have some students here that I'm going to have them introduce themselves. Some of them have had experience exposure with human trafficking, but they have an interest in this area. So we'll start here.
Hello, my name is... My name is Zoe Henderson, and I'm a social worker.
My name is Katie Ryder, and I'm also a social worker.
My name is Matthew Madison, and I'm a social worker.
My name is Tara Sievers,
and Metro.
I'm a social work student.
And I'm Kate Harrington, I'm a social work student.
Go ahead.
I'm Hilda Grand, California.
My name is Kate Bean. I'm calling from Waco, Texas. I am an MSW student at Baylor University.
I'm Carl Holland. I'm from Champaign, Illinois. I'm emeritus in social work at Illinois State University and in private practice.
My name is Heather Evans. I'm calling from Allentown, Pennsylvania. I'm also a social work in private practice.
I'm Mary Van Hook. I'm calling from the Orlando, Florida area. I'm emeritus, a professor of social work at the University of Central Florida, and I've been engaged in trafficking research with my colleagues in Albania.
Everyone, I'm not missing anybody.
Tony Summer from Bandwagon, New Mexico, presently in Pennsylvania and traveling across the country.
April Bowman from Centerville, Virginia.
This is Carrie Rose from Dove Adoptions. I also have two colleagues here with me, LaDonna Stearns and Nancy Miller.
Hi, this is Lori McGuire from Cleveland Metro Chapter, and we have three others in attendance.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for being a part of this conference call. And it's not a topic that a lot of people want to hear about. A lot of people basically are constantly saying, well, this is not happening in our backyard. This only happens in other countries, especially third world countries, Europe. But it is sad to say that it is happening here in the U.S., and it is very much alive and well. We're talking about modern-day slavery. We're talking about slavery that involves the exploitation of persons for commercial sex or forced labor. One myth that is out there is people think of human trafficking as an immigration issue. It's all the immigrants that are coming here into the U.S. illegally. But what we're finding is that the majority of the cases that we're identifying here in the U.S. are from not only immigrants, you know, that come in through the border, but the majority of them are people that come in through our airports every single day with work visas. We're talking about the homeless, homeless people. We're talking about substance addicted persons and teenage runaways. We have seen a large increase in the labor trafficking lately of people that are brought here to the U.S. with work visas or student visas, thinking that they're going to have this wonderful job, and once they get here, basically all their documents are being taken away and they're being enslaved. And some of the students, especially from Eastern Europe that are being brought into the United States, we're finding them working at strip clubs. It does often involve crossing of an international border, but it's not required to move a victim. Trafficking, these traffickers are constantly using force, fraud, or coercion to control their victims. They might, you're not going to have a victim chained to a bed or to a table, but you're going to have a victim threatened with not only weapons or the use of force here, but also threatened with their families back home. If you don't comply, I know where your mom is. I know where your siblings are. So they're using that form of control. A lot of the psychological part of the control is mostly seen on these type of cases. These cases can be prosecuted on a variety of grounds. For example, harboring illegals for profit, or you can money laundering, or kidnapping. There is a lot of other charges that can be also added to these type of cases, and we have seen a lot of cases being prosecuted under other charges and not specifically human trafficking, but that they started and they were considered trafficking cases. The scope of the problem, it is estimated that 27 million people are enslaved worldwide. I just came back from Nicaragua, and there was a report that is supposed to be coming out very soon where they're even talking about 60 million. So we don't know. These are all estimates, but these are estimates based on the cases that are being found and based on the market that it's out there. Remember, these victims of human trafficking are not seen as human beings. They're seen as merchandise. Human trafficking is now considered the second crime following drug trafficking. But I would not be surprised if very soon we see human trafficking taking the number one spot. For example, in Eastern Europe, human trafficking is already the number one crime, and it bumped drug trafficking to the second slot. Why? Because human beings, you have your drugs, you sell your drugs, and you have nothing. You don't have any more profits. You have to wait for the new merchandise to come in. But you sell a human being, and you are constantly reselling that human being to the point where you're always making a profit. It is estimated that between 18,000 to 20,000 people are trafficked annually into the U.S. Those numbers are very low estimates. We have also heard that those numbers are most likely going to be coming up very soon into the 50s, maybe 60,000 per year. And there has been cases of human trafficking investigated in 49 states here in the United States. When I started working these type of cases in 1999, there was an estimate $9 to $12 billion a year profit. Today, that estimate has gone to between 32 and 34. Most a lot of the numbers that I'm hearing from Eastern Europe, from agencies, you know, federal agencies as well as global agencies, is the $34 billion a year in profit. Now, what's interesting, and this information I just recently was made aware of, is that the International Labor Organization reports that $21 billion a year is the profit for labor trafficking, which means that if that is inaccurate based on their studies, $13 billion represents approximately sex trafficking. Now, that is something that I'm seriously looking at it, and I'm seeing that it is a huge possibility that it is true that the numbers are very accurate, because here in the state of Florida, within the last 2 years, we have seen a change. We're seeing more labor trafficking cases than what we're seeing sex trafficking. We're seeing more male victims than what we're seeing female victims. 95% of our cases of our victims right now are all labor trafficking, and they're all males. So we're seeing a change in the field of the trafficking arena. After drug trafficking, again, human trafficking is the second most lucrative business, followed by arms trafficking. Now, when you have trafficking cases, most likely you're going to have the people that are trafficking people are going to be also involved in the trafficking of drugs or trafficking of arms. In the new global economy, there is a constant source of victims. Slaves are dispensable commodities. They are often seen by traffickers as readily replaceable. Once a victim is of no use, once the merchandise, as we have been told by traffickers, is not going to represent a profit, they will dispose of these victims. The majority of time, these victims will be killed before they even reach the age of 25. They're typically recruited by not by force, but by the promise of a better life. For example, it is incredible when you travel and you leave the airport in a lot of countries in Central and South America, as well as the Caribbean, and the first thing when you leave the airport, you have this huge billboard advertising great jobs in the U.S. Well, what we're seeing is that a lot of these people that are being brought into the U.S. with those so-called great jobs, once they arrive at the airport, their documents are being taken away, and now they're basically working for the trafficker. They're not making any money, and they're just adding a debt. And the debt is the transportation debt, the renewal of the visa, the bed that they, you know, the mattress on the floor or the bowl of soup they eat a day. And these people literally are just enslaved. I mean, they can't communicate with the outside world, and the way of controlling the people is, you know, if you don't behave, I'll call immigration, and immigration will take you to jail. It is sad that now we have agencies, we have companies, we have organizations that are now recruiting using the American dream. Some victims are illegal and fear U.S. authorities. You have victims that come from countries where there is a lot of government corruption. law enforcement corruption. So they're in fear because one of the things that the traffickers will tell them is, you know it's bad in our own country, but wait until you see law enforcement here. It's worse. People are not going to help you. You're going to be thrown in a jail. They're going to torture you. They're going to rape you. As I said, the majority of the victims that we're seeing lately are coming in through the airports with these visas. Victims might be physically isolated or guarded. Other victims will be held for psychological coercion. Many of these victims don't speak English except the ones that are coming in through the airport. One of the requirements when they apply for these jobs and in order to get that visa is they need to know some English. Many of the victims have no idea where they are. These are the ones that come in through the border. But what we're seeing again in the change is that a lot of the victims that are being brought through the airports know where they are, but they don't know specifically the location of the home where they're being kept. Many do not realize that they're victims. They feel like, oh God, I got a crappy boss, or this is happening to me because I didn't do my homework. I should have gotten references. Or a lot of the people that arrive through the border feel feel that this is part of what they have to be submitted through because they enter illegally into the United States. People are trafficked for prostitution, for exotic dancing, for servile marriage, for agriculture, for 4- and 5-star hotels, for personal sexual exploitation, for begging in the streets, restaurant work, carnival, housekeeping. We're seeing a lot of the labor cases are housekeepers and people that have been hired to work at country clubs. There is also some confusion between smuggling and trafficking. And I always tell people that the easiest definition, it will be smuggling. Smuggling is for opportunity. Smuggling is a crime against the state. It's a crime against, the laws, the immigration laws. But trafficking is more exploitation. Trafficking is a crime against human beings. It's a violation of human rights. The sex trafficking of females has gotten to the point where now we are starting to see a lot of reverse trafficking, which, means that the same way we have females brought to the United States, or we have people brought into the United States to be exploited, and we have U.S. citizens that are being now taken outside of the United States to be exploited. Just to give you an example, in Argentina, we found 4 U.S. citizen girls that were basically promised a modeling job. And instead of modeling, they were being forced to work at a strip club. So what we're seeing is there is now also a shift into the reverse trafficking, not only of labor, but majority of sex trafficking. The recruitment and harboring transportation provisions for obtaining a person through force, fraud, or coercion is one of the laws in reference to Commercial Sex Act. One of the things that is very important is that when you have a minor child that is used for a commercial sex act, you don't have to prove force, fraud, or coercion. That is an automatic human trafficking scenario. In the forced labor part, it's providing or obtaining the labor services through threats of serious harm to that person, any scheme or plan, pattern that places the victim in fear, or the abuse of or threatened abuse of legal process. A lot of the labor trafficking scenarios, they use immigration as a way to threaten the victims. One of the most difficult cases to find are domestic servitude, because domestic slaves are always kept inside a home. They don't have a lot of contact with the outside world, except how we find these cases is because we have a smart neighbor that sees that something is not right and decides to report it. The situation that we have seen lately also is in reference to domestic trafficking. Because of the tight restrictions at the border with immigration, because of some of the situations in reference to difficulties in getting the work visas, we are now starting to see more recruitment taking place within the United States using U.S. citizens. The domestic trafficking, it's a homegrown trafficking. We have seen cases where parents are the ones turning their own children out. For example, we had a case here in the state of Florida where there were two sisters. One was 8, the other one was 13. They were sending out the 8-year-old to dance for the migrant workers. And once they were agitated and they wanted more, then the 8-year-old would come back home, and the parents then would take the 14-year-old, and they would charge $30 to have the 14-year-old then have sexual encounters with the clients. We are also seeing a lot of women pimps that are out there rescuing kids from the streets, and they're now recruiting them, or not recruiting them, but forcing them to work prostitutions for them. We're seeing gang-affiliated prostitution rings, MS-18, MS-13, the online recruiting, MySpace, Facebook, the iBox chat rooms, Yahoo chat, Craigslist. There has been a lot of it. A lot of people think that because they have a MySpace account and it's private, nobody can go in and retrieve information unless they authorize the person. But what we have learned through traffickers is that they have people that have experience in hacking into the computers and retrieving that information. You know, kids are placing photographs of themselves, their families, their school, the friends they hang around with, or this is what I'm doing today, I'm going to be at this mall. So what they're providing is free information for these traffickers to send out their recruiters and start, you know, looking for them. The use of technology has become now one of the most important tools for trafficking. For example, we work the Super Bowl. The Super Bowl here in Tampa, Florida, every hub, every hotspot for prostitution went was gone. But what we found out was that everything went underground, and it was being advertised using the computers. So we were finding the girls through the computer, through the technology, not in the locations where we normally would find these girls. A lot of these prostitutions or these trafficking operations are being based out of hotels. I'm not talking about, you know, Super 8s or the Red Roof Inn or the Super 6 motels. We're talking about, you know, 4- and 5-star hotels. Like, for example, at the Super Bowl, we found girls and we found brothels at 5-star hotels that were, the fees were anywhere between $900 to $1,500 a night, and they were working out of there. The strip clubs, the erotic stores, the cross-country, or what they call the circuit pimping, is another trend that we're finding a lot of these girls, U.S. citizen, domestic sex trafficking girls. What is sad is that the scope of the problem is that 2,100 children are reported missing in the United States every single day. 1.3 million runaways, and increasing at a rate of 15% each year. Our data shows that 100,000 to 300,000 U.S. children are at risk of becoming sexual commodities every year. As many as 2.8 million children live on the streets, a third of whom are lured into prostitution within 48 hours of leaving home. 12 is the average age of entry into pornography and prostitution in the U.S. Girls between the ages of 11 and 15 are most victimized members of our society. One of the things that we have starting to see is we have seen recruiters working the malls, working the movie theaters. They're going to approach a group of girls or even boys, and they're going to offer them that they're talent scouts. They're looking for new talent, for models, for people, for soap operas. And all this is just trying to recruit and trying to lure some of these young girls and boys into the prostitution. For example, I just got back from Nicaragua. One of the new things that is happening in North America, in the parts of Mexico and parts of Central America, is that now they are recruiting runaway boys, boys that are out in the streets, homeless children, but especially boys, because what they're doing is that they're injecting them with female hormones, because there is a huge demand with transvestites and trafficking. So that's something that is different. One of the things that we started doing was that we start working with the Department of Juvenile Justice, and we have gone into their database where they keep track of the runaways, and once they pick them up, they have to take a photo and fingerprint them before they release them back to the family. Well, what we have done, and I don't, the ones that have the PowerPoint presentation, you're going to see some photographs of some of the kids that we have worked with, and the photographs basically show you the child when it was the first time when it was reported missing by the family, and then what we have done is we have shown law enforcement how if they would have some type of program where every time that child has been picked up, it will pop up all the other pickup photographs, they could see that the changes that the child has gone through, and it would be a very strong indicator of potential trafficking scenario, of potential domestic trafficking. And some of the photographs that we have, the families agreed for us to use these photographs to use them for training purposes, because if their child would have been identified, probably not the first time, but by the second time, the second pickup or the third pickup, the changes were there. And if law enforcement or whoever was doing the photographs would have had that screen, they would have been able to identify that this child might be a potential victim of domestic trafficking, and they would have gotten help faster instead of waiting. For example, in the first picture, they waited 1, 2, 3, 4. It took 8 pickups for them to realize that this girl was with a pimp, and she was forced into prostitution. Again, the second, set of photographs, you're going to see the beautiful girl when she, first is reported missing. But you can see how the marks, the drugs are kicking in, because one of the things that these traffickers are constantly doing is they're constantly feeding them with drugs. They're constantly getting them hooked on everything you can think of, because they want to get them desperate, so they will do anything for them just to get the next fix. So this is something that we have done here in the state of Florida with law enforcement officials on trying to identify more domestic trafficking victims. A lot of these girls, you're going to find them out in the streets. For example, Orlando is one of our hottest hops here in the state of Florida for domestic trafficking. One of the things that we do is we go out on a weekend and we walk, we drive first, and then we identify some of the locations where we can see the pimps, and what we're looking is for the young girls, and we're going to try to make contact with them. Or if we can make contact with them because they're in areas where we know that there's a lot of drug selling and there's a lot of weapons going around, we try to film and document as much as possible so that we can then turn around and provide the information to law enforcement. One of the last outreach work that we did in Orlando, we immediately gave law enforcement the description of the girls, photographs and locations, basically the street location, everything that we had, and within 3 days law enforcement was able to rescue 4 girls, and they put 3 pimps behind bars. But it's kind of dangerous, because again, these people, sometimes they have weapons, but they always have somebody looking out for them. We try using vehicles with rental cars with different tag numbers. We don't want to use our cars, because your tag number is public record. Anyone can take down your tag, can go to the tag agency, and they know where you live and who you are. So what we try to do is use rental cars, and then also we don't use our personal cell phones. We buy track phones so that the call cannot be tracked to our personal information. But the situation with domestic trafficking is it's growing. We are seeing more and more of these type of cases. These are more difficult cases because one of the things in these type of cases is that the girls are constantly being rotated on a weekly basis, so that the girls that you're going to be identifying this week are not going to be the same ones that are going to be next week. Another thing with these cases is that they're always mixing the force, the girls that are being forced to do the prostitution with the girls that are, you know, they're professionals. They're doing it because they want to do it. So they try to mix them in. And another thing also is when you see in domestic trafficking, especially the minors are always going to have not one but at least two to three pimps with them. We have gotten to the point where there was a trafficker, a pimp, that wrote a book. And this book has basically helped us save lives because one of the things with his book is that he basically writes on how to control, how to break down a female to make her a prostitute. And I can give you the name of the book. It's The 48 Laws of the Game of Pimpology, and it's written by Pimping Ken. And one of the things that we do is we have websites that we go in to start looking for some of the locations where these girls are going to be basically being advertised. But this pimp, he's kind of a little dumb because they have their own pimptionary, which when you go into these websites, they have their own vocabulary. But this guy on this book, he has, on the back of the book, he has published the vocabulary they use out in the streets. So it makes it our work easier to identify when we are looking for these victims, potential victims, on which are the ones that are victims and which are the ones that are not. So, again, the book is The 40 Laws of the Game. It's Pimpology, and it's written by Pimping Ken, and it's on Amazon. It's only $8, but these $8 has basically saved close to 15 to 16 young girls. Well, one of the things, yes.
Would you like me to open up the lines in case there's any questions?
Yes, because I would love for questions.
Okay, let me open up the lines and we'll give people an opportunity.
If you have any questions, please feel free. I'm, you know, once I get started, I just keep going with this because I want people to understand, you know, or try to get as much information as possible in such a short time.
Do
you know how to do that? Remember, last time we had to push something and then they hear it.
Okay, the phone lines are open for anyone who has any questions.
Now, one of the things that I want to add is that the sad part that what we have seen, and we hope that there will be changes to this, is that any federal funding that has been received by task forces or any current funding on, it's only specifically for international victims. Anytime we work with a domestic victim, which is U.S. citizen, we have to use our, you know, the community to help with donations, or we have to use from our own operations fund that has not been given to us by the federal government. Do we have any questions?
U.S. victims have more problems protected.
I can't hear again. What?
Do you mean by that U.S. victims have more problems being protected than internationals? I'm not sure I understand.
Well, yes. I mean, in reference to our experience working with domestic trafficking victims, is that we cannot tap on any federal funding to help with these victims. one of the things is that we have to have agreements for shelter, and also the any financial assistance or anything that we provide the U.S. victim is using funds that we have been able to raise through community donations or funds that have not been allocated by the federal government. Then when you try to get them food stamps or Medicaid, we have not been very successful because since they're U.S. citizens, then they have to meet, you know, fall through the criteria. And working with U.S. Domestic trafficking victims has been extremely difficult because there is nothing in place for them.
Anybody have a question?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes. Thank you so much. Hello?
Yes.
This is Tony Thoma from New Mexico. I was wondering what type of personality or profile makes up a pimp? When you say you see them, they're trying to traffic girls.
First of all, when you are out doing street outreach and you see these girls, you're going to see the pimp is always very close to them. In the outreach that we have done here in the state of Florida, as a matter of fact, even during the Super Bowl, these girls are never left alone. We've learned throughout the experiences, there is also a saying, we've always heard of a saying that says, pimps up, hoes down. That we have seen. I mean, you're going to see that the girl is pacing back and forth in a set certain area, but if you start looking to your perimeter, you're going to see that not too far behind, there is going to be one pimp and there is going to be at least two or three lookouts that are going to be right next to the girl or not too far from the girl. But usually you can tell when you go out, if you park, let's say what we do, if we park the car at a location we're not gonna be seen, but we're gonna have the view of the area, you're gonna see that the girls are always gonna be protected. There is gonna be, you know, the main pimp, and there's gonna be also at least two or three lookouts that are gonna be protecting, like they say, their merchandise. Even when we did the Super Bowl, when we would call, for example, we had one of our team guys that would call to set up the appointment with the girl. We would park the car right in front of the hotel so we could have a view of the lobby. When the girl came down to meet her client, she was always with the pimp. The pimp was always standing not too far from her.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Anna, I had a question. I'm calling from New Jersey.
Uh-huh.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I wanted to ask you, and I don't know if you'll get to this when you talk about the laws, but I wanted to know where the state laws and federal laws, or which one trumps the other one. I've talked to a few people that work with minors who are involved in prostitution, and they said that in Atlanta, in Washington, D.C., and often in New York City, girls who are teenagers that prostitute are not considered victims, even though we have a federal law about it. So I was just wondering, I know that New York State last year passed the Safe Harbor Act,
mm-hmm.
but it seems like even though we have a federal law, it's not enough to trump state laws and local attitudes.
Well, and that is one of the sad things. One of the sad things that we have seen, and what you're saying is completely right, is how to get law enforcement to look at these girls as potential victims. And I'm coming from, you know, 10 years of law enforcement side. Usually, you know, they see the girls, and I remember because I heard this, you know, and even I'm guilty of it. Even before I felt, oh my God, look, if she wasn't wearing what she was wearing, she wouldn't have been raped, or she wouldn't have been in this kind of trouble. That's the mentality that is out there. But it's not until you start working more closely to these cases. Here in the state of Florida, we have a state law, but we haven't had one prosecution under the state law. Why? Because we haven't completely done enough to train all law enforcement agencies in human trafficking, especially domestic trafficking. We haven't still we're lacking of training, prosecutors and judges in the field. Just to give you an example, about a year ago we had a case of a domestic trafficking. We went in front of the juvenile judge, and instead of him releasing her to a program that we were recommended, he sent her to a mental hospital for an assessment because he saw that she was having mental problems. But that is something that is there. We have to do more about it. We have to become more proactive about it. But at the same time, it is our duty to change, that frame of mind from law enforcement that these girls are just troublemakers. They're, constantly that they are prostitutes, that they're criminals, and not seeing them as potential victims. And that is something that is really bad. Just to give you an example, you're talking about the loss. We had the William Wilberforce Reauthorization Act that was passed now for 208. Well, it wasn't until we got a huge labor trafficking case that we realized that when they passed the law, they added visa fraud, they added labor contracting in a foreign country, but they forgot to add those provisions under Chapter 77, which is the TVPA. So now you find victims that are labor force victims with visa fraud or labor contracting in a foreign country, and they cannot be, they have no benefits. They're not entitled to receive any benefits nor any visas as victims of trafficking.
No, we're still on.
And this is Mary Dan Hook. I'm just trying to clarify. So under that, if you come and labor trafficking, you don't have the rights or the protection that people in terms of the sex trafficking, is that the implication?
If you have a case that falls under the new William Wilberforce Reauthorization Act, which means under the visa fraud provision or the labor contracting in a foreign country, because that was not included under the Chapter 77 of the TVPA, those victims are not entitled to the CP or any other benefit under human trafficking. So we are trying now as a matter of fact, we are doing now a campaign where we're sending out letters to all the Congress and everyone that has endorsed the trafficking situation, requesting them to take William Wilberforce back to the floor and add those provisions under Chapter 77 so these victims are entitled to receive, the benefits that they're entitled under the TVPA. Any other question?
I'll give it a shot if anybody has one.
Do you know how to access it?
I try.
Probably just can. No,
if you look on the PowerPoint presentation, I went ahead and made some important notations on the 2008 William Wilberforce Reauthorization Act. You have the new conspiracy statute, and then you have the new fraud and labor contracting. This is mainly for the H-2B visas as well as the H-1A. These are workers that are being recruited in foreign countries, brought here to the United States. Once they're here, they're being enslaved. The contracts that they sign are not valid because they make them sign a second contract here in the U.S. And the majority of these people are being paid less than minimum wage. We have cases where we have people that are being paid anywhere between $1.50 to $3 an hour. And they're not even getting that pay because from that money, they will deduct the rent, the mattress on the floor, and we have scenarios where they're even charged anywhere between $5,000 to $25,000 for renewal of a visa. which is added as a debt. And then you also have the, under the new Wilberforce, you have the expand authority for detention as well as obstructing human trafficking enforcement. But again, these are great. They're awesome. But we didn't realize that they were not included under Chapter 77 until we had our first case. Hello?
Something on the website so that those of us interested could write letters to our congresspeople, support, adding our support to what you're doing?
That is very important. We are encouraging everybody to write to their congress, to their senators, to please let them know that we have found this loophole, you know, and that we need to include those William Wilberforce new provisions. We need to include them under Chapter 77 so that those victims are entitled to the benefits and are entitled to having a continuous presence here in the United States. As a matter of fact, I was talking...
That includes visa fraud and labor contracting.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And you should mention that to your congressperson?
Yes. Yes, as a matter of fact, we have been here doing the same. We have also mentioned that to Department of Justice, and Department of Justice, they concurred with us. They said, yes, that is true. They were not included under the Chapter 77, so what we want is for them to take it back to the floor and make that amendment to include those William Wilberforce new provisions under Chapter 77.
Do you have the legal citation before you for us to reference here in this communication?
No, I don't, but I'll be more than happy to send it to Rick so that he can send it to everybody.
That would be helpful.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And like I said, this is something that we didn't know until we came across, you know, one of our cases, and it ties not only our hands, you know, in reference to how much we can provide, how much type of services we can provide to the alleged victims, but also it ties Immigration Customs Enforcement because they can't certify them. So basically, the way we're seeing these cases now is that we have Immigration Customs Enforcement saying, oh my God, these victims were exploited. Definitely there is labor here, you know, labor trafficking. But because of the provision not being included on the Chapter 77, they have had to basically transfer the case to the Labor Department to open an investigation as labor laws violation, leaving the victim basically in limbo. Any other questions?
Anna, I had a question.
Mm-hmm.
From just kind of going back to what you said, like how you mentioned that one case with the judge, how you assigned the girl back to like a mental health thing to be reassociated. Are there any programs that you like have like associated with your Florida coalition to like help rehab the girls, or I guess what steps do you take like after you rescue them take them out of like the industry?
We're dealing with minors, we have to turn the minors over to the Department of Children and Family here in the state of Florida. The Department of Children and Family are the ones that will provide foster home. Now, what we're seeing with these type of cases is a lot of times these girls are turned back to the parents, or they're being sent to a runaway shelter that is not secured. So as soon as they arrive to the runaway shelter, within 24 hours, they're going to disappear again. so we're still, you know, there is a lack of programs. And very few, for example, we're working very closely with a runaway shelter out of the Tampa area where every week we have one of our staff members goes in and she does a presentation and sits with the girls and the boys. And she talks to them about human trafficking, you know, and all that. But that's about all we're able to do. There needs to be more programs, you know, that will be in place for these type of cases. And I, you know, it's sad to say that they're not that many.
So would you guys, like, as a Florida coalition, would you ever, like, start a program like that or...
Well, the thing is that when you're dealing with minors to start, what we do is kind of like we started a pilot in Tampa where we're going to this runaway shelter, and we sit with, you know, we do presentations and we sit with the kids for about 2 hours. But that's something that we started doing, and if it works, then we might be expanding it to other runaway shelters. But the state of Florida per se doesn't have a program that can identify domestic trafficking and can assist domestic trafficking victims at this time. And it makes it harder on us because by putting them in a mental hospital is not going to do anything. I mean, this girl, she spent 3 months in a mental hospital. She was released back to the parents. By the time they got home, she was gone. She was gone. She's back with the pimp. So, There has to be programs also to identify to be able to deal with minors, domestic trafficking victims.
I have a question about the series of pictures of the victims. You said that in Florida you have when a cop pulls up a picture of a girl, show the series of different pictures from different sites wherever they are found or something. Is that something that can be done nationally, like have that in all 50 states for law enforcement? I know you said it was in Florida. Is there any work being done to get it in other states?
I don't know about other states. I encourage other NGOs or even agencies to start working with their Department of Juvenile Justice and start working with them identifying these photographs. Every time a juvenile is picked up, it's photographed, at least here in the state of Florida. And what we're trying is for them to put up some type, you know, to establish a program where every time, you know, the picture comes in under Jane Doe, every Jane Doe priors will pop up too, so they can see the difference. Because if you look at the pictures that, you know, in the PowerPoint, you can see the difference, you know, the change of these girls, and that is a way for law enforcement to like we say, to look beneath the surface and say, oh my God, you know, something is not right here. And what they do here is they can contact an NGO that has experience in working with trafficking, and they can do an assessment to make sure that this victim, you know, that this girl could be a victim of human trafficking. But that is something that should happen. I hope that in other, you know, parts of the state, of the United States, there is other agencies that are going to be able to work with Department of Juvenile Justice to be able to identify more of these girls. And again, and boys. We have had also cases with boys.
What is the general reaction of the children that you pick up? Are they glad to be rescued, or do they fight it?
Let me tell you something. The general reaction is one that, how dare you mess up my life? You know, the language is amazing. It has taken us anywhere from 2 weeks to a month to be able to have the child open up and admit or tell you what she has been going through. The first reaction is a very negative reaction. You're the person that now is interfering with their life. We had, as a matter of fact, we had one scenario where one of our staff members was threatened by the girl, and almost 3 weeks later, the girl was, hugging her and thanking her for helping her. But the first reaction within that first week was not good. Our experience working with domestic trafficking victims is that don't expect them to come and hug you and say thank you for taking me away from this, because they're going to be very angry. The first 48 hours, they're going to be very angry. See, you have to understand that they're hooked on drugs. Now you took them away from that fix. You took them away from that so-called, that person that so-called cares for me and loves me. Even though he's forcing me to do this, but he cares for me. He loves me. He provides for me. So our experience has been very, it has been very difficult those first 48 to 72 hours.
I have a question. You've talked a lot about the victims and recognizing the victims, but have you done very much work in prevention, and what do you think is the most important things in prevention?
Well, one of the things in reference to prevention is we are now going out into the schools, and we have schools where especially high schools and middle schools, where the administration has been very, very open, and it is mandatory, or they have all the students have a 45-minute section with one of our staff members on a one-on-one human trafficking 101. So that has been very helpful. We have also been able to establish anti-human trafficking committees at different schools, not only high schools but also middle schools, as well as colleges and universities. One of the things that we do is we have PSAs. We have had students that have created PSAs. As a matter of fact, if you go into YouTube and click, go into Florida Coalition Against Human Trafficking, you're going to see some of the PSAs that were done by the students. We also do a lot of outreach out in the streets. We have, days where we have a full work day, but we have days where we basically have a group of staff members that will sleep during the day because they're going to hit the streets between 8 o'clock and 5 o'clock in the morning looking for these girls. We do have water bottles. One of the things that we have in our campaign is we have water bottles that have the label with information about trafficking. We have mirrors that we have with us that have, it says beauty supply, they don't say hotline, but it has our hotline number. And we go out and we talk to people. We go out to the church. We do a lot of work, especially within the school system, to try to prevent these girls to fall, for these traffickers. One of the things that also we're doing is we're also targeting the parents to look more into the websites. What websites are your kids, using? Are they using Facebook? What type of information they're putting? What type of photographs are they're putting in? The new trend here in the state of Florida, it's also the cell phones. They have the pimps, the traffickers now, they have what they call the 1-800 dateline numbers, where they recruit a girl, the girl might be in school, and they give her a code. She dials that code before 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and basically she will get the information as to what hotel, what time, how many clients, what is the charge, and where they need to drop off the money. Another thing that we have seen in domestic trafficking is that when you do raids, law enforcement is looking for track of records of cash. They're looking for cash money. So what we have seen also in these type of cases is that now the pimps are using the prepaid cards, and what they're doing is they're giving the prepaid card number to the girl so that the girl can walk into a Walgreens or a Walmart or wherever they take the payment, and they will basically deposit the money they made on those prepaid cards. That's to take away
to prevent the record keeping, you know, of all the of all having all the money cash with them. So, but there's a lot of things that we do out in reference to prevention, but at the same time, there's a lot of things that we're still learning every time we go out. Because let me tell you something. What I have learned is that by while I'm doing this training and telling you this is what we're doing, traffickers are already, you know, looking into what other methods to use because they know that we're going to catch up to them. So it's amazing some of the things that are coming out, I would say, on a daily basis. But prevention is one that we do take very seriously. We do have a lot of materials that go out into magazines. The schools, every time there is an activity from the school where there is an opportunity to put an ad on one of their programs, we will put an ad on the program. So we try to be as visible as possible. On the PowerPoint, there is one poster or a picture of our poster that says slavery is hiding. We have those billboards, posters. We have them all over the place. We even have them in the school system. In some of the schools, we were able to put these posters on. So,
regarding prevention and that sort of thing, one of the things would be if you could help us to recognize what signs we could look for to recognize a person that has been trafficked.
Mm-hmm. Some of the indicators.
Yeah. Could you tell us about that?
Yes. Well, one of the things that we look for is, first of all, you're going to find, if you try to make contact with them, with these girls or these boys, you're not going to have any eye contact. They're always going to be looking down. They're never going to be looking at you. Another indicator is that when you try talking to the victim, you can tell that the victim has been coached into what to say to you. You can tell because another thing is that the victim is not going to be by herself. There is always going to be somebody that is going to be talking for her. There's always going to be somebody with her. One of the things that we look for is how many people are surrounding her, how many people are going to come forward to try to talk to you on her behalf. And then one of the things that we notice, for example, sometimes we like to go out to Walmart, and especially on a Sunday, because what we've seen is here we see like a bus or a van, and you see how the victims are or the people are coming out of that van, and there's always one person that is in front of them and one person behind, but they're always walking together. They never separate around, you know, the store. That's something that we tend to follow, and the times that we have done that and we have followed and we have reported to law enforcement the tag number and everything, it has turned into a case. Victims are not allowed to socialize. They are not allowed to go to any church or anything like that. But I think that the one that really we can see a lot is there's no eye contact, no eye contact at all. If you try to talk to them, if you're in a nail salon and you're having your nails done and you try to talk to one of these potential victims, somebody's going to come running and ask you if there is a problem. They're not allowed to communicate. Same thing with the Chinese restaurants. You go to a Chinese buffet and you're going to see, you can go today to one and then go tomorrow and then, you know, go for lunch and then switch and go for a dinner and then go the week after, and you try to carry a conversation and they're not going to talk to you. Somebody's going to come and ask you if you have a problem. And then if you go out and you park the car and you watch when they leave the restaurant, you're going to see that they're all going to hop into a van and they're all going to be driven into the same house. So, you know, it's their trafficking indicators. I just keep telling my staff is, you know, just that sixth sense. You're going to feel that something is not right. Something is not right. We
everything that we have provided law enforcement, it's because something was not right. We felt that there was that the victim was being controlled, we have been very successful in those cases, but at the same time, you have also victims that are very savvy, or I'm sorry, people that are very savvy, because there is a lot of people out there that are talking about human trafficking, but when they do public presentations, they're talking about the benefits. Oh, you can get a visa, the visa can, you know. So we have had scenarios, not in our office, but we have had scenarios where we have been called out to do an assessment, and it turned out to be not a trafficking case. They were just coming up with a story just to get a visa. Yes.
Can you tell us what we would do if we actually think that we have identified someone, a client perhaps, that we are serving that we think is trapped in trafficking? What would we do?
The first thing, and the thing that I would strongly recommend for you to do is make sure that you contact immediately, call 911 or call or have with you your FBI phone number or your ICE phone number. Or you can also call the hotline, the 24-hour hotline, which is 1-888-373-7888, and let them know where you are, what you have seen, and they will make contact immediately with someone. But don't try to do it yourself. It is very, very dangerous. I mean, some of these traffickers do carry weapons. And remember, you're interfering with their profit. So they don't care who you are. They care about, protecting their merchandise because that's going to be their profit. So just make sure that if you suspect of something, call. Immediately contact law enforcement. Have those phones with you. There could be an NGO that has experience. But I always tell everybody, before you call me, call law enforcement.
Could you repeat that number for us, please?
Yes, it's 1-888-373-7888. And that is the Department of Health and Human Services hotline managed by Polaris Project, and it's 24 hours, 7 days a week. And they will contact they will get information about the state, where you're calling from, and they will contact immediately any law enforcement or task force member or an NGO that is the closest one to your area.
Anna?
Yes.
If you're not, like for myself, who's not working for a specific organization at this point, but as a social worker who's really concerned about this issue, what suggestions do you have on ways that we can get involved to be of help?
Well, one of the things is most states, they do have a human trafficking task force. What I would do is try to contact you can contact the 1-888, the hotline I just gave you, and let them know where you are, the state, and they will provide you with the agency or different phone numbers of resources that are available in your area that do work with human trafficking.
Okay, because I've tried our local coalition number, but it's always busy and nobody ever answers, and I can't get them to answer me.
Really? And have you tried calling the hotline? Because
no.
The hotline
no,
has
I,
a resource.
I just called the number that I was given by somebody.
Okay.
But I will call.
Try calling the hotline and tell them that you're interested in getting more information, because they might give you more. They do have a list of everyone, including law enforcement, working in the field of trafficking in every part of the United States.
Yeah, because
so
Orlando, I know, is a big area for the problem.
Uh-huh. And what number are you calling in?
It was Jim Gillen's number.
Oh, Tom Gillen?
Catholic Charities.
Yeah, I know. I've heard that a lot. Let me give
you... always, this, you know, this line is full. We are not taking any messages. And
let me
and
give you a contact.
And finally, I kind of gave up, you know.
Let me give you a contact person. This is one of our volunteers in the Orlando, and we do have a Rescue and Restore Coalition in Orlando that has been already working for about almost 2 years now. The number is 321-848-2202.
What were the last four digits?
And his name is Tomas. And his last name is Lares, L-A-R-E-S.
Okay.
And you can also call Giselle. She works out of our Tampa Orlando office. And it's 727-277-3427.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Sorry about that.
What was it?
As a matter of fact, Orlando is one of our most. It has a hub. I mean, Orange Blossom Trail is amazing. We have done a lot of work out of Orange Blossom Trail. And it's, you know, it's amazing because. Usually, you know, when we go out and do outreach, we do it at night. Orange Blossom Train, you can be doing outreach, you know, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and they're nonstop. Because I was there on Easter Sunday, and there were girls on Sunday. They had girls out on Easter Sunday, so.
I believe it. Oh, yeah.
I wonder why the numbers are so low, then. If it's estimated 18,000 to 20,000 people in there.
Those are very low. When the U.S. government started, you know, in the 2004, they were coming, their numbers were up to 50,000. Then in 2006-07, they went down to 18,000 to 20,000. Now, what I've heard, but they haven't done it yet, is that their numbers are going to go up. Now, the biggest problem that we have is that there is no central database. So all of those are estimates. Because nobody, they don't have, the federal government doesn't have a central database where everyone is going to report the cases and how many victims and from where the victims were coming from. So it's amazing because when you have a reporter calling your office, they want to know about, okay, I want the stats for the state of Florida. Well, I can give you the stats because there are no stats. Well, what if this, are the stats for the U.S.? No, everything is estimate. So, you know, I see human trafficking as domestic violence was 25, 30 years ago. It's still, you know, they're still growing. They're still trying to find different ways to be able to come up with more accurate numbers. But it hasn't happened yet. So we know because at meetings it has been said that they're very, very low estimates. But those are the ones that they're still coming up with. The United Nations is the one that is coming up with the 27 million worldwide, and the International Labor Organizations, they're the ones that did the study that are coming up with the amount of labor trafficking versus sex trafficking. And there is a study that is going to be coming up next year. That study is going to, it shows an increase from 27 million to 60 million. And it's going to show also an increase from 34 billion to 250 billion. So, like I said, there's a lot of studies being done out there, but we haven't seen one here in the U.S. that where everything is going centralized.
Uh,
I have heard it said that there is no such thing as really a voluntary prostitute. And I was just wondering, would you make a comment about that?
I have heard that too. I can tell you, you know, working out in the streets and working with doing outreach, we have found a lot of statements made, you know, I do this because I like it, this is what I do. But at the same time, we always wonder, you know, are you saying this because you're being coached or because you're being watched? It is very hard to say. We have come across some of the, you know, the girls that will say, you know, this is what I've been doing, this, I love what I do, this is my profession, and we have to take their word. It is very hard. I'm telling you, it. Working and looking for domestic trafficking, it's a challenge. It's a challenge because you never know what you're going to find.
Then, from that point of view, would it make sense that that folks who are trying to deal with human trafficking focus with police departments who go out trying to crack prostitution rings?
Well, that's the thing. For example, what we started doing in Orlando, and I'm going to put Orlando as an example. We had meetings with law enforcement, and they know where the areas are. They know about the girls. They know everything, but they have never taken the time to stop and get more information. Now, what happened was that then we said, okay, then we're going to do outreach. You know, they gave us a phone number in case we ran into an emergency. We even had one time where we had one undercover with us, and it wasn't until we started going out, you know, doing the outreach, and this undercover realized, oh my God, you know, not all of them are volunteer. You know, we start seeing young 12-year-olds with pimps out in the streets. And it changed their frame of mind to the point that now when they're doing these sting operations, prostitution sting operations, they always are calling us to make sure that we have somebody from our staff with them so that we can immediately do an assessment because they don't want to think that one, you know, that they're going to miss one victim. But I'm telling you, we're still learning. On domestic trafficking, we're still learning. Still learning.
Cleveland State University, a question regarding your status as social worker, because usually we say social workers do not collaborate closely with law enforcement,
mm-hmm.
And in this case it seems that you are working very, very closely to those agencies. So how do you feel about it?
Well, first of all, I started, you know, the Florida Coalition, I worked with law enforcement for 10 years, and one of the things that that I have learned in this field, especially in human trafficking, is that the only way that a lot of times we're able to go in is with the assistance of law enforcement. We have to remember that a lot of these traffickers have weapons. My life has been threatened numerous times to the point where I had to move out of my house, and now I live in a gated community, and change my cell phone number numerous times, because you are the enemy. You are the person that is trying to take their merchandise away. You have to remember, you know, human trafficking represents a profit to them. You are now interfering with that profit. So my work with law enforcement, anytime we go out to do outreach or anytime we rescue a victim, we want to partner with law enforcement because law enforcement is the only one that can, for example, if you have an international victim, I can't certify a victim. In order for this victim to be entitled to receive the benefits under the TVPA, she has to assist law enforcement. I cannot sign on behalf of law enforcement. So we have developed a great partnership with law enforcement, but we are going to be there to advocate for our victim, to make sure that our victim's rights are protected. and we haven't had any problems working with law enforcement.
I have a question. You know, if you have a rape victim, they can get assistance from Victim's Witness in California, even if they do not want to prosecute and press charges. But with a smuggling victim, or with a trafficking victim, excuse me, they have to cooperate? I mean,
yep. That's the law says that a victim of trafficking, in order to tap on those federal funding, on the benefits, they have to assist law enforcement. Even if they're seeking for the visa, one of the components of the TVPA is that they must assist law enforcement. They must cooperate with law enforcement.
Isn't that dangerous for the victim?
Oh, of course. Of course. It is dangerous because, let me tell you something, you have a victim that has provided information to law enforcement, has, you know, given statements and everything like that. And then a year later, okay, they're going to say, oh, we're going to close the case because there was not enough evidence to prosecute. And this is based on stuff that we have experienced, okay? What happens to this victim? Well, yeah, okay, if we have an awesome law enforcement officer that has signed her paperwork and everything, we're going to, you know, make sure that she gets her T visa or the U visa, depending. But if that law enforcement doesn't sign the paperwork, okay, that means that victim is going to have to return back to their home country. Now, what happens in these type of cases is the person that you're going to arrest here in the United States is not the broker. The broker is not here in the U.S. The broker is back home. The recruiter is back home. The person that you have here is the enforcer. So by sending the victim back home, or even if the victim stays here, by the victim's family being back home, they're being put in danger because now everyone knows that the victim, you know, provided statements to law enforcement. It's really a catch-22. We have had only one case that after a year and a half, law enforcement decided that there was not enough evidence to prosecute, and they closed the case. But we advocated and we fought for this victim, and towards the end, they signed the waiver, or they signed the certification so that the victim could get the visa, because it's dangerous for these victims to return back home.
Yeah. And you say you worked with law enforcement?
Excuse me?
Anna, you say you worked with law enforcement before you
yeah.
worked there? Are you a social worker yourself?
No, I'm not. I worked with law enforcement for 10 years, so my background mostly is law enforcement background. And then, excuse me?
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
And I'm curious because, you know, it seems to me that people are making clinical judgments about people, and do they have social workers that work with them?
We are staff. We have staff with social work background. Mm-hmm.
Good. I apologize. There's a couple of questions that I have, but maybe you've answered them already.
Yeah.
One is did I miss when you talked about homegrown trafficking? What exactly is that?
Homegrown trafficking, those are, it's what we call the parents that are the ones selling their children. And that happens a lot when you have families, especially families that are dealing drugs, they will basically sell their children so they can get another fix of drugs. And that does happen. We have seen a lot of homegrown trafficking right here in the state of Florida, where you have the parents are the ones pimping out their children.
Yes, there was one, a suspected one, just this past week in Florida area.
Yeah, there is one that happened, well, this one was the husband. apparently well, he's not legally married, but the common law husband was pimping out the common law wife. Now we have had, especially in the panhandle of Florida, we have seen a lot of these homegrown trafficking, where you see a lot of crack addicts, you know, pimping out their children. Another thing also that we have seen is also the homeless. As a matter of fact, there was a case here in Florida with 250 homeless people that were recruited out of the Miami area. They were taken to a farm, a potato farm, and for their work, they were basically giving them drugs in exchange for their labor work. And that's probably one of the biggest cases here in the state of Florida. And it was not prosecuted under trafficking. It was prosecuted under drug trafficking instead of human trafficking. Any other questions? Any other questions?
And you'll make sure that you'll give that specific information so we can give it, so we can add our support,
yeah,
and write letters to our Congress people.
Yep. Yeah, I'll send that. I'll send that to Rick. Hopefully today.
Okay. Great.
And I'll turn it right around, Mary.
Yeah. Sorry? Yeah. Because I'm telling you, that's something that as a matter of fact, we're even planning putting a group together, a delegation that will be visiting D.C. in January. With not only people that are working these type of cases, but also consulate offices that are seeing an increase in these labor trafficking cases. And I can tell you right now we have almost 300 victims that are in limbo that we have rescued from the labor contracting. And we have been caring for them since the beginning of the year, and we haven't seen any positive news coming out of it. The case now was referred to the Labor Department.
But see, that information you have is within the fairly narrow group, because I get emails constantly from the State Department, from various trafficked email websites,
mm-hmm.
and I haven't got any information about that problem. So
yeah. No.
Where it needs to get out so that
yeah.
more people
yeah.
can...
I mean, we didn't...
Your voice...
Right, we got the same information and everything, but we didn't come across the problem until we got the cases.
No,
so
I realize that.
Like
I got, ma'am, the problem, the more you can spread the word of the problem, the more we can
yeah,
get together.
Yeah, I know. Like I said, we just have these cases, and that's when I started making phone calls, and I'm like, okay, ICE, why this is not happening? And then finally, you know, when I got DOJ to respond, they're like, well, the problem is that we just realized that this is not under Chapter 77. I'm like, excuse me? So that's when we started moving around, and we have been, probably the last 2 months, we have been kind of like putting our efforts together on how we're going to combat this, because that needs to be changed. That needs to be changed, or Wilberforce is not worth it.
Right.
I have a question for Anna or Rick or both of you. Is it possible for us to get a copy of a bibliography?
Anna, do you have a working bibliography that you sometimes distribute to groups to whom you talk?
Yeah, I can have Lisette send you a copy of that.
Great, and then I'll turn it around to the folks who registered for this session, along with the specific information that Mary Van Hook requested as well.
Anna?
Mm-hmm.
There are a number of agencies like Salvation Army and some kind of a justice project. Do you have a list of those kinds of agencies that deal with human trafficking?
Yes, I do. I'll go ahead and send that to Richter.
God bless you.
And let me tell you something. Salvation Army has been probably one of our most outstanding partners. If it wasn't for them, we wouldn't have been able to shelter all the victims that we have found. And the last 2 years, we have rescued close to 400.
I know Lisa Thompson, and
yes,
you know her, and she spoke to NACSW. I wanna tell you that I think this is an important topic, particularly for social workers, and I think it's just awesome. I also thank you for the work that's being done in churches to make people aware of this.
Yes, and it is important. As a matter of fact, my second case, which was in 2000, the victim basically was allowed to go to church. And even though the trafficker would stay outside, she was allowed to go inside the church. And the people at the church were the ones that helped her escape from the trafficker. Mm. Now, the situation that happened in that case was that she, in order for her to continue going to that church, and the trafficker was the one that picked the church. He wanted to make sure it was a small church. It was not even her faith. She had to obtain a list of all the members with their addresses and phone numbers to give to the trafficker, which she did. The pastor gave her the list, and she gave it to the trafficker. Well, what happened was when she escaped, the trafficker went to every single house of that list looking for her until they found her. So the church is a very important tool to talk to and to bring awareness and education about trafficking.
This is we could do as social workers is to make sure that our churches become aware of it.
I agree with that statement. it is very important. We do work, as a matter of fact, we work very closely with the Episcopal Church, with the Unitarian Church. I mean, we have even gone inside the Scientology church, and we have been allowed to speak about trafficking. We have been allowed to provide them information, and they have now gone out, and they're talking amongst their Scientology groups about trafficking. The more we talk about trafficking, the more we're able to bring the awareness and education, the more people are going to be able to identify, or even, you know, if they feel something is not right, just make that phone call. All we want is for people to make that phone call.
Anna, how many residential treatment centers are you aware of in the United States?
That, I owe you that one. I have no idea. No idea.
Anna, I have a question. A more of a personal question. I'm a social work student, and I just kind of, it seems like you're dealing with a lot of stressful stories and have a lot of stress in your own life because of it. You said you've had to move, and really sounds like it's affected your family dynamics. And mm-hmm. just kind of wondering how you are, I don't know, trying to prevent burnout, or like where do you find your outlets and like your sources of strength to kind of be re-energized and be renewed and still be a healthy person, the most healthiest person you can be?
Well, you know, and I thank you for that question. I mean, it's not easy. I think that if I hadn't the support of my family, I wouldn't be able to do it. I'm not going to lie to you. There's been days that I just feel like hanging in my towel and say, I can't deal with this anymore. But you know what? Every time I feel that way, a new case comes in, and just being able to see how a new victim has been rescued, it just brings back that energy. I do, you know, when I have my times here with my family, I try to spend it as much as possible with them, or even go out to Disney World or do something, but with my family. There has been times, especially when I'm dealing with minor sex trafficking, that you do. I mean, your adrenaline is pumping, and you do everything that needs to be done, but when you come home, all you want to do is hug your kids. And I've had my weaknesses, and I've had points where I feel burned out, but I think that every time that I'm able to go to the shelter, and every time that I'm able to see how, you know, from the day we rescue a victim and how that victim has, you know, moved forward, and how that victim is somebody that now can smile, can a baby that can walk, and it's not, you know, laying down on bed all day. That is what energizes me to continue doing what I'm doing.
But there's times that I'm telling you, there's days that I just, you know, I just walk in and I say I can't do it anymore. You know, and it's kind of like amazing because the only times that I have kind of like taken time to take care of myself, it has been my body, the one that has said enough and has put me in a hospital either with a gallbladder or something to kind of put me down for a couple of weeks to kind of recover and take care of myself because I just want to keep doing, and you're right. Sometimes you have to think about taking care of yourself. Right. Any other questions?
I have another question along the same lines of taking care of yourself. Do you have people who pray for you? I really believe in the power of prayer, and I would like to join them.
I think I do. As a matter of fact, you know, let me just this Thanksgiving was very special to me because even though I was with my family, I just came back from Nicaragua from doing trainings over there. And I was able to be here with my family, but at the same time, my phone was going crazy with text messages from my victims wishing me happy Thanksgiving. That just made my day. That just made my day because all I kept thinking was that, oh my God, they're celebrating for the first time Thanksgiving with, you know, the rest of the people that we have rescued that are at the shelter, and they're celebrating in freedom. So that gave me a lot of energy to continue doing what I'm doing, and just knowing that they always end, you know, we're thankful for what you did, we're praying for you. So that to me, that's everything.
Good. Then I encourage all the rest of us on this phone call to pray for you also.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you. Let me tell you something. One of my hardest cases was a 14-year-old that we rescue with her baby. And when we brought her to the shelter and we were, you know, cleaning the baby and putting, you know, clean clothes and things like that, I realized that the baby had some marks in the back. And when I, you know, look more, the baby had been branded with the trafficker's initials. And I think that's probably the case that has really bothered me the most and has affected me the most. Imagine yourself a 9-month-old baby, no upper muscle development. All this baby can do was move eyes, move his tongues. His head was flat from laying down all the time. He couldn't sit. He couldn't do anything. And then just think about this baby a month later. He's running around, you know, with the walker, and his head is finally, the shape is changing. And you could see how healthy he was, but he will be, you know, he has been branded for the rest of his life. So we were able to find a plastic surgeon that is waiting for him to turn 5 to basically do a surgery to erase that branding.
Heavy stuff.
And in a situation like that, but that, how did you learn about her? What were?
Well, in a situation like that one of the things that we do also, we have been able to go out and provide trainings to the social work departments at the hospital, as well as the emergency room doctors. And she was at the hospital, and it was, well, her baby was at the hospital. He was brought in with bronchitis, and the hospital was the one that noticed that the man was always there, and when they finally told her that she was going to be released from the hospital, that's when she told the hospital she didn't want to go back, that she was afraid, and immediately the social work, she called us, we went there, we did the assessment, and it turned to be a trafficking case.
Okay. how important it is to get the word out all over with everybody.
Exactly. Exactly. And you know, these and some of these traffickers will use the hospital. I mean, we have even done trainings for the health departments. Why? Because the health departments, there are a lot of them that have the big fish bowls full of condoms. These traffickers will go and have the girls go inside and bring and get all the free condoms. So what we have done is we have done trainings for them, and as a matter of fact, we have one health department that when they see something suspicious, one of the girls will go outside like she's going to smoke a cigarette, and all she's doing is getting the tag number of the car that the girls are being, you know, driven on. So people get involved.
And in case you are, you know, you go, you get that trafficker or that pimp, what do you do in this situation like that in the hospital?
Well, what they do is we have trained them that if they see something like that, to immediately notify security at the hospital. Security has been trained to, but also to they do have a list of all the numbers to call, and they know that the first number is going to be 911. Just to get an officer as soon as possible. But they're smart. A lot of these traffickers, like in this case, this guy went inside, there's also other traffickers that will stay in the car, and they will send another of the girls with the person that is going to the hospital. Again, you know, these traffickers, not all of them work the same way. They have different tactics that they use. You just have to become very savvy to kind of like think, you know, you have to be three steps ahead of them. And another myth that is out there, people think that traffickers are people that are don't have an education, people that are illegals, people, you know, that are poor. We have, as a matter of fact, we have a trafficker right now, one of our cases, that he is a retired pilot from a major airline, and he's using his benefits to travel around the country to recruit people. We have a trafficker that is a master, has a master's in computer engineer. A lot of these traffickers, as a matter of fact, we have another trafficker that speaks four languages. So we have very well educated traffickers, and we have also very well educated victims. In the labor trafficking cases that we have victims with nursing degrees, we have a psychologist, we have computer programming, we have you name it. I mean, we have victims with all kinds of backgrounds. We have victims that don't know how to read or write, and we have victims with bachelor's and even master's degrees.
What would you say are some of the highest activity areas or states or regions of the country for human trafficking?
Well, in reference to highest activities, I would say probably places, for example, California, the border towns, California, Phoenix, and Texas. And in reference to the airports, New York, Florida, you know, where there is a lot of activity in reference to tourism or construction.
Mm.
Just to give you an example, when we do street outreach, for example, let's say that today we're gonna target the migrants. Okay, so what we're gonna do is we're gonna go to areas where there is a lot of Spanish stores that cater to the migrant community. Well, what I'm looking for is not the vans, is not the people that go in and out. What I'm looking for is next to the payphones or by the markets, you're going to find advertising jobs, advertising, you know, great opportunities.
because one of the things that happens is that once the migrant is here in the U.S., then you have now these recruiting agencies that are, for example, the Chinese employment agencies. Chinese employment agencies are recruiting Mexicans and Guatemalans that are here illegally. So what they do is they have these flyers that basically say easy work, men, female or males, no experience, no English, no papers needed, but then it has a requirement, and then one of the requirements is must still have family in Latin America. Well, we start pulling those out, and the result of that was that we turned those papers to ICE. They started investigating, and they found that they were connected to Chinese employment agencies out of Atlanta, Georgia, and Chamblee, Georgia, that basically were recruiting Mexicans and Guatemalans to work for the Chinese restaurant. And once they arrived there, they were being charged transportation fees, administration fees, and now they were being put in houses where they were being exploited by these Chinese restaurants. We had cases where they were being paid anywhere between 25 cents to 50 cents an hour. They were being threatened. They were being moved around with security all over the place. So from that flyer, they shut down six employment agencies in the Georgia and in Atlanta and Chamblee, Georgia, that were basically exploiting Mexicans and Guatemalans for the Chinese restaurants. So you just have to kind of like look. Anything that looks suspicious, just pull it. Just pull it. You know, get the information. Like I said, these traffickers are continuously, they're looking for new ways to recruit people. Any other questions? I don't know, Rick, if this is if there is any other questions or
we're
you
want
to say anything.
We're at about the 8 minute mark, so I'll probably in the last 2 minutes just do a quick housekeeping review. I'm leaving you about 4 or 5 minutes if you had any last thoughts that you wanted to part with us.
Well, one of the biggest things is that we just need to be out there. We need to be vigilant. You know, there is a lot of lot of information that is being put out there. You know, and I've sat, you know, through presentations, and I've heard people talking, and they only talk about human trafficking as sexual exploitation and only illegal migrant workers or illegals, you know, that enter the border. And what they don't realize is that the trend has been changing. We have to remember that the human trafficking law, the TVPA, talks about labor trafficking, talks about debt bondage, talks about domestic servitude. Under the William Wilberforce, it talks about visa fraud. It talks about labor contract in a foreign country. We have to understand that a lot of these victims are arriving through our airports every single day, and some of these victims have higher education that we are, you know, that more than higher education. But the most important thing is that we need to understand that we have to expand. We need to open. We need to look beneath the surface. We need to start looking for the victims, because if you expect a victim walking into your office and saying, I am a victim of trafficking, it's not going to happen. You're the one that has to kind of be more vigilant and start looking for them. And trust me, you might have gone to a restaurant to eat Chinese food, and maybe the person that came in to ask you if you wanted, you know, what do you want to drink, could have been a trafficking victim. If you went to a nail salon and had your nails done, that could have been a trafficking victim. If you had something done in your house, your lawn maintenance, that could have been a trafficking victim. Or even if you went to a hotel, your beds, you know, the housekeeper could have been a trafficking victim. They are here, and they're we can see them. We are coming across them every single day, but we can't identify them. And that's what makes me angry. How, you know, what can we do, you know, to be out there? We need more people to be out there, to be more vigilant.
Great. And on behalf of NACSW, let me express my appreciation for such a passionate and knowledgeable presentation on a topic that it's hard to think of one that's more important for our community and for people of faith and social work to know more about and to be able to do more about. I'd like to also express my appreciation to everyone else who participated in this session. I think the questions, particularly in the second half, really made the session, so I appreciate your participation in that way. We would greatly appreciate receiving your evaluation of today's audio conference and hearing your suggestions for future audio conference topics. I'll be sending out to you within the next 5 minutes an email survey link where you can provide your feedback and, again, let us know how useful this session was for you and give us ideas about sessions that we might be able to schedule in the future. For those of you interested in obtaining documentation of continuing education contact hours, please download the 10 post-training questions posted on the website. This was something that we give you a link to when you initially registered for this workshop. Send your answers to these questions to NACSW, and again, feel free to contact me with any questions you might have about earning those CEUs. Lastly, I'd like to invite you to consider signing up for our next audio conference workshop, which is scheduled for February 22nd. It again will be at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And I did want to notice that starting with this February session, audio conference workshops and CEUs will be entirely free to all current NACSW members. The topic in February will be Seeds of Justice, Cultivating and Empowering International Partnerships. It will be led by Elizabeth Patterson, who's both an assistant professor at Malone University and also served for 5 years as coordinator of the Veritas program in Romania and has supervised field experiences for students through the Romanian Studies program as well. So again, thank you for joining us today, and we wish you all a good rest of your day. Take care then. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Anna.
Thank you so much.